I'm Dave Freund, and this is The Next Page. And I am still flying without my right-hand person, Marissa Norcross, who is still on maternity leave, but I do have a special guest with me today, my nephew, Rob. Rob, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rob, why don't you introduce yourself to our listener?
Sure. So, aside from being your nephew, I'm a mental health counselor and once full-time, now part-time, college instructor for mental health counseling. So I was living up in Central New York this past year, moved back to South Florida this past summer, and now I'm working at a substance abuse treatment center part-time, teaching part-time, and also doing some private practice work.
Great. And in your private practice, what type of work do you specifically try to focus on?
Well, I actually do a lot of work around with individuals and couples and families. Working with couples is definitely a passion of mine. So I do a lot of work with people who are working on strengthening their relationships or who are struggling with decisions over do we stay together, do we break up. I do some work with co-parenting issues, things like that. But then I also do a lot of individual work. And what I've noticed lately is that my work has come around a lot to things like spirituality, defining your purpose, interestingly enough.
Yeah, you got to practice on me.
Yeah. I don't know if maybe that tipped a scale somehow or something, but a lot of sort of getting in touch and connecting with who you are and how that translates into a sense of meaningful, purpose-driven life. So I do a lot of work. Great. With people that connects to those issues, whether that's with depression, anxiety, relationship issues, other mental health concerns and things like that. But we do a lot of values-based work. Yeah.
Great. That's awesome. And so, you know, folks probably first had me reference you back in June when you helped me find my why. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I remember, you know, because you and I, even though you're my nephew, we lived like thousands and thousands of miles apart. Yeah. for most of your life. And then all of a sudden you were planted in Syracuse for almost a year.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
And one of the things that I even said to your dad once, I said, you know, wow, Rob really helped me figure out who I was in terms of, you know, for years I thought I just had all of these neurotic tendencies and I was pretty messed up mentally. And then I find out that I'm not that messed up. So it was really good.
Well, I joke sometimes with people saying, you know, we're all a little messed up. And if all of us are, then none of us are on some level.
That's true. And I like the question that we always ask people. So really, what is typical?
Yeah, exactly. There's actually a quote from the Addams Family, of all things, where Morticia Addams says that normal is an illusion. What is normal for the spider is chaos for the fly. And I love how that communicates the idea of relativity perfectly. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, Rob, for our listeners' sake, when I was going through the process of discovering my why or discovering my purpose, my calling, whatever you might want to call it, I had actually asked you, and you know, you and I, we both had read a book that Simon Sinek had put out called Find Your Why. Mm-hmm. And they heard my perspective of what our meeting was like when you and I spent a couple hours together. But when we came together, what were you doing to help me?
Sure. When I think back to it, there are really two big things that come to mind for me. The first is sort of a general skill that I think is useful for everyone, in that whether you're in business or you're in the helping professions or you're simply trying to be a good friend or partner or fill in the blank, that really comes in useful. And that's active listening, being able to really be mindfully present for the conversation and try to connect with what the other person is saying from their perspective. That's something that we talk about a lot when we're training future counselors and things like that. But I find that, like, in my marriage or in my friendships or things like that, or in this experience with you, that really was an important thing to, you know, not get lost in my own thinking about what you were saying, but to really just be present with what you were actually saying.
Right.
And I think that's where the patterns emerged for me in a lot of ways. The second part of it that really stood out to me is another thing that I use a lot in my counseling work, which is reframing. And that's essentially, you know, you mentioned about your neuroses and feeling like you have all these baggage issues and things like that. But reframing is basically taking someone's perspective and then offering them literally a different emotional or mental frame around that. So every Sure. weakness can be a strength and vice versa. And so it's looking at, well, here's another way of looking at the situation that maybe helps it to become more useful to you. And so I found myself doing that a lot. I think we all fall into these patterns of self-judgment and Mm-hmm. our perspective sometimes limits our ability to see things from multiple angles. So really doing this with another person provides a great opportunity to have someone say, well, if you look at it from this angle, maybe it's not damage, maybe it's not neuroses, maybe it's not a weakness, maybe this is actually something that contributes to a beautiful part of who you are. So I would say those Sure. are the two big things.
Thank you. And you know, one of the things that really struck me was there were things that I and this is something that I had shared with you even before we were doing my Find Your Why session there. But you know, where I talked about the fact that, you know, when I was young, I used to do things like have my slippers angled toward the door in case mm-hmm. there was a fire type of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that when someone that was a somewhat friend of the family, but somebody I didn't know really well wanted to take me out to dinner. And I was, I think maybe 11, you know, I put my address in my shoes because I had heard about a lot of kids getting, mm-hmm. getting abducted. And I remember saying, wow, that I must've been really like warped or weird or something. And you viewed it as, And I think you worded it this way. You said you viewed the world as a dangerous and chaotic place, but that's something you could prepare for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it really, to me, that really struck me that things that I really thought were serious issues when I was younger. I mean, it's not that like I lay awake at night worrying about those things anymore. But when I was younger, I wondered, why do I have these weird thoughts right. and things? And you actually framed it in such a way for me that it was actually a strength.
Yeah,
which was giving me courage to address things like that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, where things like that start to feel like a shortcoming or a limitation are really oriented around the distress that it caused you to feel like you had to prepare in that way. You know, as a kid, you know, all you knew was the anxiety that prompted you to put your phone number or your address in your shoes. But looking back on that, it's okay, well, anxiety can actually be a hugely productive thing, especially when you have a strong sense of self-efficacy, which you do have. So the anxiety is, rather than being something that paralyzes you or causes you to run away, it causes you to gear up instead.
Right.
And you tackle things head on. And that, like I said, you know, I think that's a strength to you. Where that might maybe impede your effectiveness is if it does get to a place where the anxiety is detracting from your ability to enjoy the experience or to feel right. like you're really tackling it in an effective way. You know, if you're judging yourself really strongly or you're condemning yourself if things aren't done perfectly because of that anxiety, mm-hmm. that can maybe get in the way. But I think that has to do more with a person's flexibility or the rigidity that maybe they bring to it, to their experiences. And as long as we're able to keep that in a flexible space of, you know, nothing's ever going to be perfect, but I can at least be prepared. I think right. that can be an asset for sure.
Awesome. So that's why I love having conversations with you. Because it just it makes so much sense. One of the things that you said a little bit earlier was that the anxiety was actually it can be a very positive thing. So mm-hmm. that there's something that's causing us to feel anxious.
Yeah.
And if we can take that anxiety, that anxiousness, and verbalize it to someone, mm-hmm. they might be able to help us understand how that could be reframed into a very positive thing.
Oh, absolutely. There's something that is so incredibly healing about the power of empathetic connection when we're in strong mm-hmm. emotions like that. You know, to be able to take that anxiety and bring that to someone and say, you know, I'm really struggling right now, and they don't try to fix it. They don't try to invalidate your experience. They just try to understand where you're coming from and then really connect right. with you in that place. That's where so many creative solutions are found. Yeah, absolutely.
So the blog post and I did send you the draft version that I had on my laptop here just to let you know what's coming, mm-hmm. what came out this morning at the same time that our podcast did, you know, what the title was, You Can't Go It Alone. And I use an example in that in my blog post of, you know, having, we have a very long, long driveway, and you got to experience my driveway over last year when you would come over Sunday night for dinner.
Yeah, and I experienced having to get some help with that driveway too.
Yeah. Well, actually one winter, and this was when I think you and your family might've been living in Puerto Rico at the time, but AAA had to come to my driveway twice in the same day to get different people out of the ditch, so to speak. But this, what came to mind was when I had a Ford Expedition, extra long, the EL version, and I was backing down my driveway and I start to go off into the grass. Oh, this is no problem. I have a four wheel drive. I'll just horse it right through. Well, all I did was horse myself farther into the snowdrift. And there I'm standing in the frigid cold temperatures wondering, what do I do next? And our neighbor, Eric, pulls out of his driveway and he just gets to the end of my driveway and rolls down his window and says, do you need some help? Yep. You know, and I even had a tow strap in the back of my truck, and he was able to pull me back out of the ditch. So none of us can really go it alone.
Yeah.
And we need people in our lives.
And I think there's actually a really great anxiety-related factoid that connects well with your story, and that's the idea of the Yerkes-Dodson anxiety curve or stress curve.
Okay.
Basically, it's if you ever have seen like a bell graph or a bell chart where it's sort of an upside down U shape.
Yes.
And what this graph represents is basically the relationship between anxiety and performance, or stress and performance.
Okay.
And so if you think of it as performance being on the y-axis, the up and down axis, and stress being on the x-axis, the one that's horizontal, when anxiety is really, really low, we tend to perform low. You know, when I teach this to students, I talk about how if I'm not feeling stressed out about this big exam coming up, I'm not really going to do a whole lot of preparation for it because I feel like I've got it, you know. But as the stress starts to increase, maybe time goes by, I get closer to the exam, my stress starts to go up. And so I start to feel the urge to actually prepare and to perform. And so just like there's that upside down U, every person has a peak level of stress that they need in their lives to be able to perform at their maximum. And when stress goes beyond that point, so let's say my ideal stress level is a 6, but as I get closer to a 7, 8, 9, all of a sudden I start riding that bell curve down, and my performance actually starts to decrease to where if I'm at a 10 in terms of stress level, I'm performing as if I didn't care at all in terms of my ability. And in your story, I was reminded of that because, you know, you're cautiously going down the driveway and whatnot, but in that moment you think, well, I've got it. I've got to get out of this driveway. I can do this by myself. There's this sense of kind of the performance careening off to the side. You end up in the ditch. And I think that when the stress levels are high or when we're struggling with something, getting someone to help us, to connect with us, is a great way of bringing that pressure back down to a manageable level so that we can get out of the ditches and things like that.
That's awesome. I love that because I never thought about the reality that the stress is really what's helping bring out our peak performance.
Yeah.
But when you push it beyond the peak, you literally get to like, you don't care.
Yeah.
That's terrific. So, let's begin to unpack that. So is there a way for me as an individual to know when my stress is getting to the point where I need to talk about it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is where getting other people to help you out is such a useful thing too, because especially if you're in a position of leadership or you're in a position of management, it's always really useful to have, a few people that you trust and that you can really rely on for honest feedback. This actually comes from a few different people, but most recently in terms of what I've gotten it from is Brené Brown and her work on leadership and her work on vulnerability. But she says, you know, make sure that there's someone who can give you honest feedback and ask people, how do I become, what do I become like when I am not functioning at my best and when I'm getting stressed out or I'm making poor decisions and things like that. And their feedback can often help us to recognize sort of the weather signals of I'm getting to that place where I'm not being productive. And there are patterns that people fall into, such as either being over-functioners or under-functioners in times of high stress. Interestingly, there tends to be some birth order influence of that. At least that's what the anecdotal evidence seems to suggest.
Really?
That if you're a firstborn, whether in truth, or what we'd call a psychological firstborn. So a psychological firstborn would be someone, I believe, like you, because you and my dad are about 5 years apart, right?
Yeah, and I'm actually the youngest.
So. Okay, so even though you are chronologically the youngest, because there's that huge age gap between you and my dad of five years, intellectually and psychologically, you tend to function more as we would expect a firstborn. So what that would suggest is that when you're really, really stressed out, you're probably going to go into overfunctioning mode.
Okay.
And when we get into overfunctioning mode, that's where we find that we're sort of burning the candle at both ends. Rather than delegating, we're taking on more responsibilities. We have a hard time trusting other people to be able to handle tasks that we feel like we should be able to do because we know how it needs to turn out. And so we sort of burn out on our overfunctioning. And if we fall more into the younger born camp, which is myself, because I'm the youngest of four, and there's only 3 years between me and my older sister, even though I'm the firstborn son, so that creates a weird mixture for me. So sometimes when my stress level is a little bit on the lower high end, I overfunction.
Yep.
But if it really pushes into the higher ends of stress, I start underfunctioning and I become paralyzed. And it starts looking like I don't care. And things don't get done. Deadlines get missed, things like that. So recognizing what you do, sort of sitting and evaluating, what do I do when I'm really, really stressed out, can be a great way to see your opportunities for growth, but then also having people that you can connect with and who you can trust to give you that information and that feedback can also be a really useful thing. So I think taking that two-pronged approach can be a useful strategy.
Well, that's awesome. And, you know, as you were talking about that, I started thinking about a couple year span at SelfLock, you know, when I was running that company and things were very difficult and we had a move and there were cost overruns with the move. And the more stressed I got, the more hours I worked.
Yeah.
The more time I put into it, you know, and if I wasn't at work, I was thinking about work and literally, you know, becoming paralyzed to think objectively because I was in a constant state of exhaustion trying to work through the problem.
Yeah.
When if I would have had somebody say, you know, why don't you go take a week's vacation?
Yeah.
And let's talk about this when you get back. And I just, yeah. And I remember one day specifically my family being on vacation out at Otisco Lake and driving from work to the lake. Family's there. I got out of my car. I looked at my email. I got back in my car, went right back to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought they can't handle this without me.
Yeah.
When, yeah, they could have handled it without me. But so that was that other thing about thinking that, you know, they wouldn't do it as well as I did. So that's really telling. See, you should have been here like 6 years ago. You could have saved me. I'd probably still have a head of hair if you would have been here then. I wouldn't have lost it all.
Well, I would have been a very little use to you though, because I don't know if I, well, yeah, I just started my master's program 6 years ago. So I would have been useless to you at that point probably.
All right. Okay. Well, so I'll forgive you for that. So that's awesome. That information, that is so good. So let's talk about now, If I'm a person that is that trusted helper or advisor, you know, and you talked about active listening. So what's that, you know, you did say it's like listening to it from my perspective, but what are some tips that you can help us with to maintain the focus on being an active listener and not just trying to give our point of view type of thing?
Okay. Well, the first thing that actually comes to mind to me is if someone is reading Simon Sinek's book, Finding Your Why, there will be some good tips in there on active listening. The first being, if you know that you struggle with this, take notes. And don't take copious notes, but at least use keywords and things like that. And write down the things that stick out to you so that you don't feel like you have to get trapped in that narrative, but that you can jot it down and come back to it later. And that'll jog your memory to it, but you want to keep up in the flow of what the other person is saying. So note-taking can be a really useful thing.
Great.
I think that active listening requires activity. It's part of the name. And so what that means is that if you're listening actively, you're asking questions to get more detail. You are summarizing what the other person is saying when there's a natural stopping point. So I think I remember when you and I talked, I did a lot of, let me see if I understand this correctly. And then I kind of told it back to you. And
yeah,
and
you did.
Gave you the opportunity to clarify or add to. That can be a really useful thing, because as much as we want to try to be unbiased listeners, we're always filtering things through our own perceptions. Getting the other person's feedback on how I'm hearing it can be a really useful thing. So asking those clarifying questions, summarizing and reflecting things back to them. The other thing that I think is really useful about active listening is that it's not just allowing the other person to talk. It's also asking questions. So in motivational interviewing, which is one of the styles of engagement that I'll use in counseling, we use the OARS acronym. And the O for that stands for open-ended questions. So that might be something like, how did that impact you? You know, putting those addresses in your shoes, or what was that like for you, as opposed to a yes-no question, which is more about confirmation or rejection. So asking open-ended questions is a great way to continue the narrative and build your understanding, and gives the other person the opportunity to sort of add to the story and flesh that out more. So I think that's another great way to engage in active listening. And the last thing that immediately comes to mind for me, I think, is maybe one of the more difficult things, and that is cultivating a sense of internal stillness while you're listening to the other person.
Okay, explain that. I think I know what you mean, but explain it.
So when I am at my least effective in my clinical work or my relationships and things like that, it's when... as the other person is talking, I'm already formulating a response, or I'm getting caught up in my own emotional reaction to what that person is saying. And people say things that trigger a lot of different things in us, whether that's great ideas or memories or feelings, things like that. And when we're engaging in active listening, it's important to remember that in this moment, the conversation may be about the two of us, but in this moment, my listening to you is about you. And so I have to be able to, I call it mindfulness, cultivate a mindful attitude where I'm aware when my mind is starting to wander. I'm aware when I'm getting caught up in emotions or things like that. And because of that awareness, I'm saying, all right, I'm aware that this is happening. I'm going to set that aside and redirect my attention to the other person. And for some people that comes really easy, but for some people that requires a lot of work. And so mindfulness and cultivating internal stillness really is a benefit if that can be a daily practice that people do, because that will help you to really be present when you're having those conversations with other people.
That's terrific. You know, and I noticed that in two coaching sessions that I had just today, where I had to battle that for whatever reason today, I was battling that really hard. Mm. And it was just multiple times I was inserting my own thoughts and my ideas into the conversation. It's like, okay, relax. Don't even think that thought right now. Get back to what they're saying. But yeah.
I love that you said relax too, because it really is this idea of sort of relaxing our grip on our own thoughts, on our own experience, so that we can sort of gently come back to the other person or the other aspects of our experience that are important to us. Yeah.
Right. This has been great, Rob. I really appreciate it. And so when if we are that person that is the helpful colleague type of thing, you know, it's not about us, it's about them. And the worst thing we can do is go in there and solve their problem.
Yeah. And I don't want people to come away with the idea that like you don't matter in that process.
Right. Yes, yes.
But it's rather that we're creating space for the other person's experience, and we don't want to crowd that out or impose ourselves on that. Yeah.
Thank you. And so oftentimes, you know, what I find in my coaching, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when I'm sitting there listening to this person, oftentimes they have the solution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they haven't discovered it yet.
Yeah.
And by asking those open-ended questions, you know, or I actually was on a training call today, and I heard someone say, don't ask them what you're feeling, ask them how it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And I just thought that really struck me too.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's so much, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, please do.
There's so much in the different kinds of counseling that speak to that, you know, from Carl Rogers, was the founder of humanistic Rogerian therapy. And so his philosophy was exactly that people inherently have the strategies inside of them that are going to help them to be successful. And so by extending our mm-hmm. compassion and our non-judgment towards them, we create a space where they're allowed to discover that. Alfred Adler suggested that every negative symptom or unhelpful problem is actually an attempted solution. And so it's about helping people to take those things that are seen as problematic and helping them to view it from a different perspective so that it can become a strength or an active problem-solving process. And then there's Insoo Kim Berg and others who did solution-focused therapy that basically said that if there's a time in your life when that problem didn't happen, where there's an exception to that rule of failure or whatnot, there's already the recipe for success in that. And so much of any kind of helping engagement, coaching, counseling, otherwise, I honestly do believe is about helping people to uncover that natural healing process within themselves and the resources exactly. that they bring to the table. Yeah.
That's great. So this has been awesome, Rob. I really appreciate your time. I know you've got a young family, a wife and a daughter waiting for you. But this has been huge. And for me, just, you know, there were so many takeaways here. That it's going to take me a while to process them. But I really appreciate it. And I hope that, you know, in the not too distant future, you and I can connect again, and maybe we'll get Marissa on the call as well, and she can hold us both accountable.
Oh, that'd be a lot of fun.
Saying some things that are meaningful. Well, thank you so much. And again, thank you for helping me find my why, because it really made a difference. And I really appreciate all the conversations we had, and I'm sure our listeners will have a lot of takeaways from this as well.
Oh, my pleasure.
So thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
And with that, this was The Next Page.